President Donald Trump's election left many federal employees wondering what direction their agency would head. That includes the vast Defense Department, and with a flurry of early activity marking the Trump presidency, we wanted to get a sense of what defense analysts think of what might be ahead for the Pentagon. Dr. Nora Bensahel and retired Lieutenant General David Barno from the School of International Service at American University spoke with Federal News Radio's Eric White.
I think one of the striking takeaways is that there's been a flurry of executive orders, some of which have been relatively disruptive, and it's been, you know, the administration's hit the ground running and they are moving out and making changes, and a number of those are in the domestic sphere and a number of them are in the foreign policy sphere. So I think, as we noted, the Pentagon is going to continue to have a significant role in many aspects of these, although I think the foreign policy changes have not emerged as quickly and as clearly as some of the ones that affect our borders and other things like that, or that are, have more of a domestic component.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I would say that there still are a bunch of very important decisions to be made that will influence the scope and nature of U.S. national security policy. One of the things that we've seen already that was kind of interesting was the decision to announce the executive order on immigration at the Pentagon, not only with Secretary of Defense Mattis standing there, but in the Hall of Heroes, which is a sacred place in the Pentagon where all of the Medal of Honor recipients are honored. And it was quite a striking scene for, quite a striking setting for something that has national security implications but isn't directly about national security, especially with the Secretary of Defense standing there in the background. It was a very interesting choice of location.
So do you think that signals an integration kind of more domestic issues becoming national security priorities?
Now, I think that's actually, in some ways, I'm a bit skeptical of that choice. It was not a coincidence that President Trump, in one of his first major actions, decided to put that in that setting immediately after swearing in Jim Mattis as the new Secretary of Defense. In effect, you know, he was able to use the setting, the fact he was in the Pentagon, the fact that he had the new Secretary of Defense, who is widely respected on both sides of the aisle, part of a completely unconnected signing of an executive order, I think was actually a way of leveraging the respect that went with the Pentagon, with the Hall of Heroes, and with Jim Mattis to provide support for his executive order implicitly, even though I don't think that Mattis would have been too enthused about that particular choice if he was aware of it in advance.
We're speaking with retired Lieutenant General David Barno and Dr. Nora Bensahel. They're with the School of International Service at American University. So on the kind of disagreements going around the Pentagon, you talked a lot in the article about divided Pentagon. Has there ever been so many voices having different motivations in the Pentagon than what we're seeing now?
I don't know that the Pentagon itself is divided. I would characterize the divisions more as the Pentagon on one side of a lot of these issues and perhaps the emerging National Security Council and its membership on the other side of the issues. That I think that's where the fault line is most likely to lie. In both cases, interestingly enough, you have a sizable number of retired generals and admirals lining up with really some divergent viewpoints on some of the major issues that the Trump administration is going to be taking on, whether it's how existential the threat is from radical Islam or what role the U.S. should play in Iraq and Syria to expand the war against ISIS. I think you're going to find some significant divisions emerging between how that looks to retired three-star, Mike Flynn, who's the National Security Advisor, and versus what might be the opinions of Jim Mattis, a retired Marine four-star Secretary of Defense, or even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, four-star Marine Joe Dunford. So that's where I think the actual fault lines are going to lie, as opposed to within the Pentagon itself, although it's not clear yet who the Pentagon civilian leadership below the Secretary are going to consist of either.
But something very important also happened, which didn't attract a lot of attention, which is that the first U.S. Military fatality during an operation happened under the Trump presidency. A Navy SEAL was killed in a raid in Yemen that was, according to all reports, things went wrong during the raid, and it was did not proceed as planned, and that was what led to the death of the Navy SEAL. That raises all sorts of questions about how this new White House, this new administration is going to think about the use of force. One of the things that we wrote in our column is that this is an incredibly inexperienced team so far in national security, you know, at the White House level, very little experience in these issues, you know, certainly for President Trump and his political advisors. And so one of the key roles of the Pentagon is going to be to highlight some of the consequences, risks, and trade-offs of the use of military force to really make sure to put all of those out there and help the political leadership understand what some of the second, third, and fourth order consequences are of using military force. To have an example of a combat fatality in your, you know, first days in office, I'm sure has had an effect on the Trump administration, how they process that and how they, you know, start thinking about the use of force and the policies that they will pursue remains to be seen.
So on the Pentagon workforce, we've heard about dissent in other federal agencies. Is there any possibility of, you know, something like that occurring in the Pentagon, or are people pretty or people more dedicated towards following orders and implementing the policies from their superiors?
Well, the big difference is in the State Department, there is a formal dissent channel that the process which can be used. The Defense Department doesn't have anything like that. It's a very different structure. And certainly you would never get any active duty members of the military commenting on policies because that's inappropriate. You know, they follow the commander in chief. There is reporting that there is, you know, a lot of dissatisfaction among civil servants in the Pentagon. You've already even seen Secretary Mattis push back, for example, on the piece of the executive order that would prevent all people from Iraq from coming into the United States because that directly affects Iraqis who were U.S. interpreters. So, you know, he's come out against that. But, you know, you're not going to see the same kind of memo, the same kind of opposition, partly because of the nature of the Pentagon and the uniformed military, but also because there is a formal channel that encourages that kind of thing in the State Department that just doesn't exist in the Defense Department.
And let's talk budget. Mattis this week ordered a new series of new spending plans to kind of have better targets for the long-term future. How is the Pentagon going to work with Congress, you think, in the upcoming years to maybe end sequestration even, or even just have a more balanced budget when it comes to defense budgeting?
I think that's going to be one of the really interesting issues to watch because one of the reasons that there's been a cap on Pentagon spending that dates back to 2011 and the imposition of the Budget Control Act is that both sides of the aisle, but in particular Republican fiscal hawks in Congress, wanted to cap the amount of increase in the deficits each year and actually put a hard cap on the national debt. That debt was allowed to float, but only because the Budget Control Act, you know, limited deficits, you know, out through the year 2021. That's now up for grabs. I think there's a very good possibility that the Budget Control Act is going to be set aside and that this new Congress with a new president who's talked, you know, very strongly about increasing military readiness and increasing military capabilities, the budget review that you know, holdover Deputy Secretary of Defense Bob Work is going to lead in the Pentagon, is going to come in with some new requests for spending, even in this current fiscal year, much less in 2018. So I think it's going to be very interesting to watch the realities of a Republican-led administration arguing for higher spending on defense that will break the budget caps with a Congress that still consists of both defense hawks who support that idea, but also many Republican fiscal hawks who have been against it for years and years and years. It's a dilemma.
It seems unlikely that the president is going to get an increase in the defense budget that would fund all of the things that he promised on the campaign trail. Senator McCain, as the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, released a white paper within the past few days that outlines what he supports for expanding the military, both in terms of end strength in the services, readiness dollars, and so on. And they are a significant increase over where we are today, but a lot of those don't match what candidate Trump promised while he was running for office. Just for example, he supported increasing the size of the Army to 540,000 active duty personnel. The statement that Senator McCain put out would have the number capped at 518,000 by 2022. So it seems likely that defense spending will go up. The question is, what does it get spent on? And because the sequestration and the Budget Control Act caps have constrained the DoD budget so much anymore, how much is going to provide really new capabilities and really new additions rather than just filling the hole that's been dug over the past few years? That's, of course, very important, but, it's not clear how much new will be added beyond just fixing the problems that we've had in the past few years on spending.
Retired Lieutenant General David Barno and Dr. Nora Bensahel are with the School of International Service at American University. You mentioned the increase in troop size, but also he was calling for upping the size of the naval fleet. And we saw him interacting with the private sector on the F-35 and Air Force One. Do you think that there will be changes in the relationship between defense contractors and the way that they work with the Pentagon and the administration?
I think there's no question, and that's already begun to occur as he's calling up CEOs of defense companies and basically negotiating with them or cajoling them into reducing the price, the unit price of everything from aircraft to ultimately other weapon systems out there. That's unheard of for any previous president of the United States, and it's having an effect on how the defense industry thinks about their relationship with the government, how they're going to connect with President Trump in his first couple of years in office, and potentially what the pricing points are going to be for a lot of these weapon systems out there. So it remains to be seen how that unfolds, because we've never seen anything remotely like this before. But it's very clear that the president himself is going to be involved in how much a number of these large defense systems cost. And if you're actually trying to increase things like build out more ships in the fleet, the cost of some of these platforms are huge. And so it'll be very interesting to see if that gets altered at all by the fact that the president himself is willing to go to bat to bring some of those prices down.
And you said that it's unheard of. What kind of contact has, or if any, has any president or administration official ever had with a private sector company involved in the defense contracting field?
I'm unaware of any contacts between presidents and CEOs that directly talk to the issue of weapon systems prices or what the Defense Department is willing to pay for a certain capability. Clearly there have been meetings in the past between presidents and the heads of some of these companies on a broader policy basis, but none that I'm ever aware of that involved actually negotiating price points and trying to bring down the prices by, suggesting alternate, weapon systems to compete with the ones that are already being bought by the department. This is all uncharted territory, to the best of my knowledge.
How can the administration establish a sound defense policy that our allies and even our foes can see that, okay, we can take them seriously now, and we don't have, there's no more way to test and prod the administration to see what they're going to do?
I think that we're in for a very unpredictable period where our friends and allies are going to be deeply unsettled by what they see as potential unpredictability in U.S. Foreign policy and on defense and security issues. President Trump doesn't have a big track record, in these issues, and what he said on the campaign trail is very worrisome for many of our friends and allies around the world. I think that there's a lot of nervousness and a lot of waiting and seeing now that he's actually been inaugurated what the policies will be as opposed to the campaign rhetoric. But if he does actually implement a lot of his campaign promises moving towards bilateral bilateral negotiations rather than multilateral ones, moving away from multilateral institutions such as NATO and so on, that's going to create a lot of uncomfortable partners and allies. And, taken over time, they may start calculating that the United States is a less reliable partner to work with in the future and may choose to recalculate how best to pursue their national interests. So I think, we very much don't know yet, but there's a lot of concern out there about where the United States is going to be, especially for our allies, whether the United States is truly going to follow through on our alliance commitments to other countries.
I think, again, the Pentagon, because of the number of experienced, both political appointees led by Jim Mattis at the top, and then also the tremendous years of experience that the senior military leadership have in the Pentagon, are going to provide kind of a bedrock cornerstone of sober thinking about some of these problems that will hopefully keep the administration well informed on not only the opportunities out there, but what some of the grave risks are that go with the use of military force, so that better decisions can be reached in a White House that has next to no serious foreign policy experience. So they're going to play a very important role. The dynamics that go on behind the scenes, particularly between who has relationships with who among the retired generals and the serving generals, will be important as well. And I think the upshot of all that is the Pentagon, led by Jim Mattis, is probably going to be one of the most important institutions of U.S. government and stability as we navigate down this road of uncertainty in the next couple of years of this administration. And it's a good news story from the standpoint of having that there in the Pentagon, and hopefully they'll be able to exert influence to continue to keep the administration better informed as it goes through a pretty steep learning curve.
So you think that Trump will kind of take a WWMD, what would Mattis do, approach to things?
I think that question will get asked on many significant issues, and Mattis will weigh in on the significant issues, but that doesn't give us any suggestion to what the president's ultimately going to decide, because his own viewpoints are shaped by a range of life experiences that have nothing to do with defense and foreign policy, and also by very close advisors who don't have much experience in that arena that he relies upon, perhaps even more than he'll rely upon his Secretary of Defense. That's yet to be seen.